Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday's school shooting in South Florida was the 18th school shooting this year, according to Every Town for Gun Safety. There have been 30 mass shootings so far this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. A mass shooting is defined as an incident where four or more people are shot, not including the shooter. On today's Your Call, we are going to begin by talking about gun violence in the United States, and then we'll continue with our regularly scheduled show about class. Joining us right now is Sarah Smirin, a volunteer with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, thank you for joining us. You know, I wanted to bring you on because, again, 18 school shootings this year. I'm so afraid that we're becoming numb to this kind of gun violence.
Well, I don't actually think we are becoming numb, because I know there is a grassroots army of over 4 million moms, dads, aunts, uncles, you know, grandparents who are working for Moms Demand Action in Every Town to prevent gun violence. But I do think what we are seeing is a direct result of our elected officials inaction and refusal to pass laws addressing gun violence.
According to polls, this is really important, the overwhelming majority of people in the United States want gun control, background checks. 87% of Republicans, 84% of gun owners, just basic background checks. So the percentages are very high.
They are, and over 70%, I think it's over 70% of NRA members approve background checks. But the fact of the matter is that, our elected officials are not representing the will of the people. And as you said, today is February 15th. We are a month and a half into 2018, and this is the 18th school shooting. This shooting, which killed 17 people, is, I think, 3 out of the 5 deadliest in the past 5 months. I might be having my numbers wrong. I was trying to pull up some research while I was waiting for you. But, you know, the numbers are horrific, and the public outcry is loud. And it's our elected officials who aren't listening to their constituents.
Well, let's talk about those elected officials and the power of the NRA. You know, the media tend to cover these horrific shootings the same way. They talk with officials, teachers, as they should. But what they neglect to point out, most of in the media broadcast, I should say, is that the National Rifle Association spent $419 million on the 2016 elections. That's $100 million more than they spent last time. And the NRA spent a whopping $30 million on Donald Trump's campaign. And now these numbers come from an audit obtained by the Center for Responsive Politics. I mean, these are massive numbers.
Right. So, look, the NRA, the NRA, you know, many, many decades ago was started as an organization to support sportsmen and hunters, and they believed in background checks and laws that protected people from the damage that guns can do. Today's NRA would be unrecognizable to its funders. Today's NRA has one single clear mission, which is to allow anyone to get their hands on guns at any time. And in order to do that, they have funded, you know, politicians, and they've been very savvy about it. They started in state houses and even in towns and cities, funding people who would support their agenda. And so now what we have is a Congress and even a president, who have their positions in part because they were funded so well by the NRA. What has happened as a result is that gun violence prevention advocates Moms Demand Action in Every Town included, have taken our fight to the states, and we are now fighting the NRA back on the state level, and we've been incredibly successful doing that. The fact of the matter is, we shouldn't do that. You know, we should have federal laws. In the United States, the gun murder rate is 25 times higher than in other peer nations. Mm. Other countries across the world have citizens who are mentally ill. They have citizens who struggle with depression and other issues. They have domestic violence. But what they don't have are 19-year-olds able to legally buy an AR-15 and stockpile other weapons and go into a school and shoot people. Mm-hmm. And the one, right. So the one reason for that is our laws, or non-existent laws.
So at this point, groups like yours feel that they have no other choice but to do most of your work at the state level, because so many politicians at the federal level are bought and sold. I mean, we should also mention that Trump's speech that he gave this morning is going to get coverage all day today. He talked about school safety and mental health in that speech. But on May 20th of 2016, he told the National Rifle Association's annual conference in Louisville, Kentucky, that he will never let them down. He said, quote, "I will never let you down."
Right. And by the way, Donald Trump rolled back in the Obama era regulation that made it harder for people with mental illness to purchase guns. So Obama created a rule that allowed people who either received a Social Security check for mental illness, or who were otherwise, you know, deemed unfit due to mental illness, to be added to the National Background Check database, which meant that had a background check been done on them, they wouldn't be able to get their guns. And Trump nullified that regulation. So if he did anything, he made it easier for people with mental illness to get their hands on weapons.
Talk a little bit about what you're doing at the state level, because people are so outraged over this, and you know, they want to know what is most effective at this point. So what actually works at the state levels?
So, first of all, we know the most effective law is background checks and universal background checks. I mean, we know that without a doubt. In states that have background checks, the numbers of suicides, the number of women killed by partners, and the number of law enforcement officials killed by a gun is dramatically reduced. It's almost by 50%. The second thing is that we now have a patchwork of laws across the country. Because there are not federal laws, laws differ from state to state. Here in California, it's important to note that we have some of the best gun violence prevention laws in the country, if not the best. So universal background checks, number one thing that we can pass in every state across the country to ensure that guns don't get into the hands of people who don't have them. Other important significant laws include domestic violence restraining orders that keep guns out of the hands of domestic violence abusers, guns that encourage safe storage, and in addition, laws that push back on the NRA's agenda of guns anywhere, anytime, like guns in schools and guns in bars. One thing I do want to note is that here in California, we passed a gun violence restraining order law, and some people call it a red flag order or extreme risk protective order. But in California, if a person is in crisis, a loved one or a law enforcement official is empowered to seek removal of guns from that person. And the law follows domestic violence restraining order laws, allowing due process. So there is a very clear laid out system that would allow that person to a legal hearing and the opportunity to respond to arguments that they are too dangerous to have a gun. And the judge may only issue the order if they have proof that this person poses a significant danger to themselves or to others. So this is really a landmark law. Washington State voted a GVRO law last year. Connecticut and Indiana have similar laws. But I think this is crucial. And I might just add, if you are listening to this call and you think that this might pertain to someone in your family, there is a website called speakforsafety.org, which has a lot of information about what this law is and how to request a petition. And
I mean, I'm glad that you're having success at the state level, but just even hearing all of these different laws, I mean, it's such a patchwork, right? And what happens for people who live in states where Republicans can control the legislature and they're the ones who get money from the NRA? I mean, it's just so awful that we have to have a patchwork of laws. California might have strong gun laws, but Florida or Texas won't.
It is, and we are so lucky to live in California. There are members of Moms Demand Action working across the country tirelessly to push back on the NRA's agenda or to fight for laws that just keep guns out of the hands of domestic violence abusers. And, you know, we've had incredible success, but it's thanks to really hard work. And, you know, as I'm sure you know, what we need to do is vote out these elected officials. If you live in a state and are represented by someone who refuses to support basic common sense gun violence legislation, vote them out. Get to work. It is terrible. It's terrible. I mean, last night I picked up my 10th grader from the train, and I wanted to know if he had heard what happened, and he said, "Mom, I can't talk about it. I have a lot of homework. I can't think about this right now. I can't talk about this right now. I can't think about it." Hmm. And you know what? He shouldn't have to. He should not have to talk about it, think about it, and neither should his peers across the country. Kids should be safe in their schools. It is a right. Parents should know their kids are safe in their schools. It is a right. And our elected officials are... that they, you know, have, I believe that they, you know, are grossly misserving the public.
Yeah, I mean, we have an email from Natasha who says we need to expand our mental health services for youth, mandatory mental health classes. Why don't we offer more of this? I also want to point out, because this isn't getting much attention, the New York Times reports that Jim Gard, a math teacher at the school in South Florida, said the 19-year-old who carried out the shooting was obsessed with a girl at the school to the point of stalking her. And that's just a really important piece, because there's often a girl or a partner involved in a lot of these shootings. Of course, every case is very different, and I'm sure we're going to learn a lot more, because this young man, boy, is still alive. I mean, most of these killers die. This guy's alive, and, you know, we'll hopefully learn more about what happened in the coming hours and days. We're going to do a whole show on this. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your work.
Sure, Rose. Thanks for having me. And if I might just add, people who want to get involved can text ACT to 64433 and get involved with their local Moms Demand Action chapter. And I really appreciate you taking the time today to talk about this.
All right. Thank you so much. Sarah Smirin is a volunteer with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. You can text ACT to 64433. And for those of you who don't text, you can find information on our website. Again, a couple facts. The NRA spent $419 million on the 2016 election, surpassing any previous annual NRA spending. The group spent $30 million on Donald Trump's campaign. This is according to an audit obtained by the Center for Responsive Politics. And on May 20th, 2016, Donald Trump told the NRA convention, "I will not let you down." Well, we wanted to add that to today's show just because it's such an important issue. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll continue with our regularly scheduled show. We will be joined with Anna Sale. She's host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. And we will talk to Anna about class. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Joining us in studio is radio journalist Anna Sale. She is the host of WNYC's podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. She recently aired a series of podcasts about how people experience class. The project is called Opportunity Costs, and it explores the impact of class on aspects of people's lives from housing to education to having children. And Anna Sale joins me in studio. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. I should say that Anna will be on a panel called Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief, tonight at 6 o'clock at the Commonwealth, Wednesday, February 28th at 6 o'clock at the Commonwealth Club, 110 The Embarcadero in San Francisco. So you host a podcast called Death, Sex, and Money. How did you come up with the idea to focus on class?
Well, I feel like class is something that we all feel deeply in our bones and rarely have the words to talk about what we're feeling. I recently moved to the Bay Area about a year and a half ago. I live in Berkeley now. My team is still in New York. And I feel like both in New York City and in the Bay Area, class is so in your face all the time. And I felt like I wanted to hear more personal stories about how we're processing that, because it's not something you always talk about with your friends. It's not something you talk about comfortably with your family even all the time. So what we did was we asked our listeners on the show to send us stories about a moment when they felt their class status. Because often if you're asked, what is your class? Where do you think you fit? People will say middle class, you know, and that's this catch-all that's basically meaningless now. So we wanted to capture these very concrete moments where you fit, how you feel difference from people around you, how you're navigating that in the most important personal relationships in your lives, how all of that was affected by class. We wanted to explore those stories.
It's interesting that you say class is in your face every day in the Bay Area. What was that like for you when you first moved here? What struck you the most?
Well, first of all, moving here and being like, how am I going to pay for a place to live?
Right.
You know, it's that feeling of, I feel like this is such a contested space right now about who gets to feel like they belong here, because the cost of living has been spiraling out of control for so many years now. And that's something that is, it's not just an abstract question that people think about. It has very real consequences for where you live, what you do for work, what your life can look like, because money matters. Even if we don't like to talk about it out loud, money really does matter.
And you live in New York, so seeing people on the streets is an everyday occurrence for you there. But did you expect to see that much here in the Bay Area?
I think that, like, in New York, you have to interact with class more directly in a way in New York City, because if you're not rich enough to take private cars everywhere, you're at least probably on the subway every so often. So you're at least seeing this combination of people who are sharing public space. In the Bay, I feel like you can somewhat insulate yourself from what's happening depending on how you live your life. But that doesn't mean that it's not, you know, class is not completely changing how people's lives look here.
Mm-hmm. You interviewed a wide range of people about a number of issues, marriage, education, housing. what this question's always like, I can't pick one, but what really stood out for you? Did any theme come up during those interviews?
I think that what we heard over and over again was, God, I think about this all the time, and it's so hard to talk about. Mm-hmm. The first episode in the series was two best friends, two women, one named Kat, one named Christine, and they had been friends since college, and they're now in their 40s. And they hang out a lot. They are best friends. They have been alongside each other through all the major milestones in their adult lives, but they don't have a comfort and a fluency around talking about class, and they have very different resources. One is self-identified as sort of more working class. She works in the theater world in Chicago. And another came from more family money and now has more money. And that really became a very stark factor in their friendship when they both were struggling to get pregnant. And the one with more money had more options because of the cost of fertility treatments. And even Christine, who has less money, felt like her medical providers were offering less options because she wasn't insured. And so that's like such an essential part of they both wanted to be parents. One of them became a parent, one of them didn't. And that's because of class. And they talked directly about that for the first time on the episode.
We actually have a clip from that conversation in that episode. We're talking with Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. And she aired a series of podcasts about how people experience class in a project called Opportunity Costs. And here is a clip.
It's because it's like, okay, so let me get this straight. Like, she's adopted a kid. They've bought a house. They're pregnant. Okay. Like, there's a whole lot of money wound up in that. And a whole lot of happiness. And I didn't have either one of those at the time.
Hmm.
But you can't say that to someone who you know has struggled really hard herself to get those things.
And that is a clip from Opportunity Costs. It is a project on class and the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. Anna Sale, today's guest, is the host of that. What's interesting is you get hit with inequality every day in this area. There's just so much of it. But it's interesting to see two friends talk mm-hmm. about it.
Yeah, because also, you know, a lot of times as your life changes, you become more isolated around who you're around mm-hmm. class-wise. If you don't have the money to go to expensive restaurants, you might not go to hang out with your friend who likes to go to expensive restaurants. So I love that episode because they have figured out a way, even as their adult lives have looked, become quite different looking because of the kind of work they do and the kind of money they have, that they still do have this very wonderful love that is the special kind of love in a female friendship. But that doesn't mean it's not without its complications and difficulties.
Mm. Well, we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to weigh in on our conversation about class, what does it mean to you? Obviously, there's social class, economic class. It's so interesting because we're having this incredible, much-needed conversation about race. How can we also add class to that conversation? We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by Anna Sale, creator and host of Death, Sex, and Money, a podcast from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. And they just worked on and completed a project called Opportunity Costs, Having Honest Conversations About Class. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss media coverage of North Korea's participation in the Winter Olympics in South Korea. In the opening ceremony, athletes from both countries wore the same uniforms and carried a unified flag. We will also talk about the sections of the White House budget that calls for cuts in food stamps and replaces monthly benefits with a cardboard box of non-perishable goods. Here in the United States, 42 million million people use food stamps. That's tomorrow. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined in studio by radio journalist Anna Sale. She is creator and host of Death, Sex, and Money, a podcast from WNYC Studios. And recently, Anna and her team ran a series of podcasts about how people experience class. And one of the questions to listeners was, when was a moment you felt your class? And if you'd like to join us on this conversation about class, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. As Anna and her team found, it's not just about money, it's about education, it's about access, aspirations, and identity. And we have an email from Mira who says, can you talk about the differences between social and economic class? Money is not the only determinant of class.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that we purposefully didn't narrowly define the kind of class stories we were looking for, because it is a term that is kind of just hard to pin down. But we heard all kinds of stories about, I feel my class status when I eat this kind of food, or when I go into this kind of social space and feel like I don't belong. Or a lot of times it was like, I make this much money now, but because I grew up this way, I still very much identify class-wise with this other economic class. So I think that we tried to use that to our advantage as opposed to narrowly defining class, because I do think class is something that you, when you feel other, like when you feel like, oh, I'm noticing I'm in an environment where not everybody else has a college degree and they may make more money than me, but I'm college educated, and so I feel a little bit, I'm aware of that. Or you show up at your boyfriend's house for the first time, which is a story we heard, and the mom asks you to set the table, and there's many, many forks, and so many forks that you're like, where do all the forks go? That is also an experience of class difference. So we asked our listeners actually to define class. That was another exercise we did. We said, when we say class is, like, what does that mean for you? And we heard a whole range of answers.
Mm. What stood out for you when you asked that question?
It was, my favorite answer was a woman who just said, class is a level of pride and shame. So we actually took that and asked our listeners to answer that question of when they think about how they situate themselves class-wise, what is it that makes them feel proud about that, and makes them feel shameful? And so you heard a lot of stories. So someone who might have a lot might say, you know, I'm really proud of myself for building my own business and for being able to provide quality childcare for my kid, but then also feel a lot of shame that an awareness that that's not something that everybody has the opportunity to do. Or someone who feels proud that, they are doing the best that they can with the money they have access to, but the shame is that it's still not enough. So no matter where you sort of feel like you fit class-wise, it was interesting to hear some people could say, I feel like this is a way I can feel like own this identity, and this is a way I want to feel, or, you know, I kind of want to downplay it.
What about differences between generations? Because when I think about my background, I mean, it's amazing how much has changed in just two generations. But that's really changing now. You know, we're hearing that children are not doing better than their parents. Did that come up in many of your interviews?
Yeah, we actually asked our listeners how they felt compared to their parents. And this is not a representative sample, of course. These are people who are downloading our podcast. And we found that about a quarter said they feel like they're in the same class position as their parents. And about 40% said they felt higher. About 28% said they felt lower. One big factor, I think, was like what we saw and listened, the two episodes back to back that I thought were really interesting, was we did one episode with a young man who's now a doctoral student at Howard University, African American, grew up middle class on a military base, but was the first in his family to go to college, and is now about $200,000 in student loan debt. as he's pursuing a doctoral education. So he's going to get a PhD and then have this immense debt to pay off. The next episode in the series was a father and son who now self-identify as being in the 1%. The father made a lot of money by starting a business, and the son, who's actually a UC Berkeley undergraduate student, had this very interesting dynamic where he was trying to kind of pushing his dad to talk more honestly about their wealth and what it meant in terms of their responsibility. But what you heard hearing those two back to back is this undergraduate student who wants to go into computer science but doesn't want to go off and get a developer job. He wants to stay in academia. That's something that he can think about completely differently than Ramal, the Howard University PhD student, because he's not going to have student loan debt to pay.
Right.
And so I think that thinking about how we're financing our higher education is a big variable to think about when you think about class mobility.
What really struck you about how people from different races answer this question? Because after the election, we constantly heard about the white working class. And Samantha Bee had a segment recently that I thought was brilliant. She said, "We're going to go to Pittsburgh to talk to working class voters." And they were all people of color.
Mm-hmm.
She walks into this bar with a bunch of white men. You're thinking it's white working class voters. And then she goes to the back of the room and it's mostly black and brown women.
Yeah.
And yes. Which is what the media, when you say working class, the media tend to talk to white workers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's become, that's another thing we were trying to sort of speak back to, which is the way we talk about class. We'll talk about class when we're talking about white people. But if you're a person of color, we're only going to act like race is the factor in your life. And of course, that's not how things work. They interact. And in our series, we talked to Ramal, the African-American student, Vic and Nishant, their South Asian descent. But the most interesting conversation, maybe not, but another interesting conversation about race that we had in the series was the fifth episode. A guy named Ernie, who's a retiree who lives in Vallejo, actually, in a single wide trailer. He's a white guy. And he now he sort of has this position of, you know, he's went to college, but he enjoys hanging out, biking on his motorcycle on the weekends, hanging out with people who he says kind of feel like they're from a lower social class, but that's where he feels comfortable. But what we talked about in the episode was sort of how having white privilege, you can be sort of less bought in to what class can mean for you in terms of the respect that you can demand, you expect from society. You know, he's a white guy, so he knows he's going to be treated with a certain measure of belongingness, whereas Ramal, the PhD student at Howard, says at one point in his episode, "I have to do this. I want to be seen in a certain way as an African American man. And secondly, education is my only shot. This is what I have to do. So, sure, it's costing me hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loan debt, but that's what this is about for him."
Today we are speaking with radio journalist Anna Sale. She's creator and host of Death, Sex, and Money, a podcast from WNYC Studios. And they recently worked on a project called Opportunity Costs. And they asked listeners, when was a moment you felt your class? And you can join us, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on social media. Let's hear from Jean in Alameda. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. The reason why I called is there's two aspects of my comment. One is race and one is class. I'm African American. I live in Alameda, and Alameda is a very desirable place to live right now. It wasn't when I moved here in 2010. It was just another place to live. But the one thing that I noticed is when I meet people and I'm outside of Alameda and you tell them I live in Alameda and they live there too, here too, they'll say, "Well, where do you live?" It has its distinct neighborhoods. There's the, you know, Fernside, Old Money side of town. Then there's Bay Forum, which is kind of new money too, but it's a little bit different. And then there's the West Side, where there's more, I'd say, working class. I don't know, I don't like that word, but more people that are not so wealthy. And it's very, very, it's everybody that you meet outside of Alameda and they tell you they live in Alameda, they want to know, "Well, where do you live?" And I'm like, that's really strange. And another thing that I want to know, that I want to say about the Bay, about San Francisco, I've worked in San Francisco for a long time. I moved to the Bay Area in the 80s, and it's such a different place. The place that I find is the most snobby in the Bay Area in San Francisco is the financial district, particularly in the area of Embarcadero Center. Not only is it about class, but the looks that you get. There's not very many African Americans that work in the financial district, and so when they see you, and you're not, and you know, and you look good and you're confident, it's like they look at you like, why are you here? I can't believe how much this place has changed. It is very sad, the Bay Area, particularly San Francisco. And I just wanted to express my opinion, because when I'm in San Francisco and I'm in the financial district, I hardly ever see anybody African American working there besides myself and maybe a few others.
Yeah,
I don't know what the problem is. This place has become more racist than I have ever seen in the 30 years that I've lived here. It is very sad. I just wanted to tell you that, because it's probably something that people don't really talk about a lot, because they think of the Bay Area and San Francisco to be so liberal, but it's not. I find New York and Los Angeles much more nice and friendly than the Bay Area. I never thought I would say that, but it's true. So thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling in, and I think it's really telling the way that your comment started about class and it moved into race, and I think it's important for all of us to hold all these things in our mind simultaneously, because obviously they all interact with each other. And Jean, one more thing that I wanted to add. When you said the word snobby, I kind of smiled, because I grew up in West Virginia, which is we used the word snobby a lot to talk about how we felt about other people. Like, there was such an awareness of feeling like people outside of West Virginia looked down on us. So we would talk about how people were being snobby and snobs and all this stuff. And then I moved to New York City, and it was really interesting to me that the word snobby sort of wasn't part of the cultural lexicon. It was because I think that the sense of the way that New Yorkers thought about people who had done very well and were prosperous, you thought of them as sort of it was aspirational to be that way. you didn't slight them by calling them snobby. So I think even noticing like that you use the term snobby is an interesting part of the class conversation. And again, when you talked about how people try to situate each other class-wise by not talking about class, but by saying like, oh, where exactly do you live? Mm-hmm. Like, which neighborhood do you live in? Because that's another way we try to just kind of figure out where on the ladder you fit, like compared to me, and whether I feel okay about that. We're talking about this all the time without talking about it directly.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jean, for calling in and sharing your story. And Jean makes a great point, because I don't remember the stats exactly, but the percentages of African Americans living in San Francisco has just declined over the years. And she's right about the financial district.
About it being snobby?
I've had my experiences, yes. Thank you for calling in, Jean. Let's go next to Maria in San Francisco. Hi, Maria. Welcome to the show.
Hi. There was one more thing I wanted to say, that being from a military family and growing up in Spain, the military tried to put a law into force that would prevent African Americans from coming to Spain. The Americans refused to sign that in the contract. However, when I came to the States and found out that black people had no status, had no class relevant to the white class, I was so shocked. And there were signs that said colored only.
Mm.
And I had a good friend that you know, anyway, it's just, it was awful. And I can't believe the racism in this country. And that is a whole nother topic about poverty, because they don't have a fighting chance. And that's all I wanted to say. But I was so shocked. I was just so shocked. And I had to fight racism all through school, all through work. I mean, I worked in hospitals, and racism towards black people is awful. And I just wanted to say that that's a whole nother tragedy in this country.
Maria, what is your experience like today?
Well, like today, I rode the bus, and there were not very many seats, and I'm hard of breathing. But people were helping each other out, and it's on a very poor line, number 14 in the Mission. And I've seen that a lot. I've seen where there's a family situation in the Mission that doesn't exist anywhere else in San Francisco. I think there's a family situation in the Tenderloin when I was living there, but it was just too dangerous.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience, Maria. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I guess a couple of things. First of all, just personally, because of my living situation, limited income and living in subsidized housing in a very affluent community, I identify as lower class economically. I've lived here for over 50 years. I never felt this way growing up, but Palo Alto has changed a considerable amount. So that's one thing. I mean, my own personal story, I definitely identify, even though I'm not homeless, but certainly is lower class. The other thing I wanted to get to, I mean, so that's sort of my personal story. The other thing is that in the political discourse in this country, the references, it seems to center, and doesn't matter whether it's left or right, on working class or middle class. Those are the, if you will, buzzwords that people use. You rarely hear any discussion about, excuse me, the lower class or the upper class. That, I mean, even Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
I never heard the words lower class come out of Bernie Sanders' mouth. Or poverty. He may have uttered them, but mostly it was focused on working class and middle class. And I think that's really unfortunate. For me, the whole issue of class and race are the two things that I'm most interested in, as well as the environment. But those two things, I think, are so intertwined, it's hard to separate them out. I think one of the things that happens with regard to people who end up either in the working class or lower class is the real sense of what the hierarchy is like in the country. Now, you get treated very differently if you're poor or working class than people who even are in the middle class. So it's really strange that that's the way things work out, and it's unfortunate that in our political discussion there really isn't. I mean, somebody says, why does class exist? You know, I mean, why do so many people fall into, quote-unquote, the lower class? But those people are ignored, and they're a huge portion of the population.
Huge.
So thank you for your work.
Thank you so much. I mean, we're going to talk tomorrow about the 42 million people who are on food stamps in this country. And California, a very wealthy state, now your home state, Anna, has the highest poverty rate in the country. And yet, Greg is right. Politicians rarely talk about poverty or the, quote, lower class.
Yeah, I think when you hear even Democrats who are trying to talk about opportunity, we'll talk about people in the middle class or those struggling to get into it. And I think that's it's sort of this interesting, like, what came first, chicken or the egg? Like, are politicians responding to the fact that most of us as Americans want to think of ourselves as at least lower middle class, whether that's at all connected to our economic and social realities? We want to think of ourselves as being part of this big middle, even as the middle class is getting smaller, as there are more poor people and more super rich people. But not only do we not talk about poor people, we also don't talk about wealthy people or people, rich people. And I think that that obviously has a big consequence for how our public policy ends up looking when we don't have these terms that we're being honest about what the American population actually looks like.
It's so true, because sometimes I read the business section a lot, and you see these CEO salaries, and I always do the math, and you learn that they're making like 40 grand an hour or 40 grand a day, but it's a lot of money. And I wonder if the larger public realizes just how extremely wealthy people have become.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the episode with the family who had significant means in this series, Vic and Nishant, as I said, the father and son. It was really novel to hear someone who has a lot of money talk honestly about the emotional experience of having a lot of money. Vic is the father, and he talked about when he was building his company, you have this idea in America that if you are hustling really hard and working really hard, you're going to earn a lot of money, and that's your goal, that when you get all that money, it's going to feel really satisfying. And he has this wonderful quote where he talks about thinking about Cinderella, and when Cinderella ends up at the end of the fairy tale, all of the people she left behind were the mean stepsisters and the mean stepmother. And he's had the experience of realizing all the people who worked for him, or he worked alongside as he was building his company, who still don't have much money or don't have nearly as much money as he does, feeling that difference and noticing his sense of deservedness versus them is not what he thought it would feel like, was interesting to hear someone articulate. Hmm.
Anna Sale is host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, and they recently aired a series of podcasts about how people experience class. We have time for a few more callers. Let's hear from Nina in Oakland. Hi, Nina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. I just wanted to semi-piggyback on something that I believe her name was Jean was saying about the Bay Area, San Francisco. She was speaking about the financial district in particular. I am coming from a little same perspective, yet different in some way. I also lived in the city for decades and find the same exact thing that she did. So she's listening still. I totally understand what she's saying. I hear it. I see it. And it's really sad. And, I'm at a loss. I'm just at a loss because I loved that city so deeply for so long and now find it like an inhospitable place to go. I now live in Oakland. And kind of the same exact story. Used to be very kind, liberal, open feeling around here. And in the last 6 years, it's gotten tighter and tighter. I unfortunately have had to go on permanent disability, going from a very well-paying job to going down to permanent disability. The way that people treat you is absolutely shocking. Mm. Basically, people look at you like, well, kind of like, what's wrong with you? Like, why can't you, quote unquote, make it? And what I find to be the saddest part of it is the lack of compassion. Mm. I mean, I'm upset by, you know, what happens financially, of course. I'm lucky enough to have disability, but what really breaks my heart is this racing around, trying so hard for everybody, trying so hard to make a living in the Bay Area, that the sense of compassion and love here that used to be so strong and beautiful is like almost erased. And much so, I find like if I could move to another place, I would. And believe me, Bay Area has been my home of homes in my heart for decades. And I feel like I'm living in another, I don't know, state, country, place, town, not Oakland, not the Bay Area. I don't know this place anymore. I am not familiar with this terrain of sadness and desperation and lack of compassion. And I just wanted to, and, you know, instead of talking about politics necessarily or money necessarily, which are all obvious huge components, you know, just the lack of compassion is just breaking my heart. And I'm sure a lot of people out there probably feel the same way.
I feel the exact same way. And Nina, would you stay on the line and give our producer, Laura, your contact info? Because I think we should do a show about this. We just got an email from another listener who said, I am working class. I'm a white person who's lived in the city for decades, and I feel sick about what has become of it.
I think, Nina, what you said about connecting the lack of affordability with the lack of compassion, that more and more people are feeling a more and more desperate sense of needing to hustle and compete and grab whatever scraps there are to be able to afford to live in the Bay Area, and that you connect to sort of feeling that overall sense of losing, diminishing compassion here is really important to think about. So thank you for adding that.
Thank you so much, and I hope we can bring you on for a future show. This topic is so important, and we're getting a lot of similar emails. Let's take one more caller, Tim in Berkeley. Hi, Tim. We're almost out of time, but go ahead.
Rose, you know, I listen to your show a lot, and I keep coming up to the same conclusion that what's happening is capitalism breeds all
this. Can you turn your radio down,
yeah,
Tim?
Down.
There you go.
Capitalism breeds all this, you know, and until we fix our system of how we distribute money and how everything's done, you know, you keep talking about the same things over and over. It's capitalism. This is what capitalism does. And, you know, you always act so shocked at the disparities, but this is what capitalism is. And, you know, until we address that, we're going to keep having these problems. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Well, we do a lot of shows about capitalism and the policies that have really resulted in this mass inequality. I mean, it's not like we don't talk about that, Tim, but what did you talk with listeners about, or the people you interviewed, about capitalism, about policies, about how that affects them?
Not really. We tried to kind of reverse the way into the story, to kind of lift up the personal experiences, so then to think about, oh, what I'm experiencing is not just personal, it's structural. Mm. Like, I'm not the only one feeling this sense of a lack of a dignity or struggling. All of this is at deathsexmoney.org/class. That's where the Opportunity Cost series is, if you want to check out those episodes. But thanks for such thoughtful calls, everyone.
Yes. Do you plan to revisit class?
Class
in the
is not going away. Yes.
All
I
right.
think there's much more work to do.
Anna Sale is the creator and host of Death, Sex, and Money, a podcast from WNYC Studios. You can check out their project, Opportunity Costs, at yourcallradio.org. Anna will be on a panel called Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief, on Wednesday, February 28th at 6 o'clock at the Commonwealth Club, 110 The Embarcadero in San Francisco. Coming up tomorrow, it is our weekly media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of North Korea's participation in the Winter Olympics in South Korea. In the opening ceremony, athletes from both countries wore the same uniforms and carried a unified flag. We will also talk about sections of the White House budget that calls for cuts in food stamps. In the U.S., 42 million people use food stamps. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Laura Wenis produced today's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.